Welcome to this episode of Real Space Strategy. I'm your host, Christopher Stone, Senior Fellow for Space Deterrence and Warfighting at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies in Washington, D.C. Real Space Strategy exists to provide you, the listener, a reality check on U.S. space policy and strategy, while giving you insight into the processes required to achieve a credible deterrent and warfighting posture for the United States Space Force. The views expressed by the host and guests in Real Space Strategy are those of the host and guests and are not to be attributed or considered part of any government entity or private sector company. In the past few months, tariffs and so-called trade wars have been terms thrown around in the news and on policy sphere in Washington, D.C. Many in Congress, allied capitals, and others in media have been making commentaries and editorials on the evils of tariffs and its negative impacts upon the United States and its industrial base. Is this the complete story? What might be getting overlooked in this discussion and debate on this important strategic issue? And what, since this is a space podcast, what might that impact be to the space industry? To discuss this and related matters, Dr. Brent Zarnik returns to the podcast. And before I welcome him, I want to mention to the listeners that one of his two PhDs is in economic matters and his other is in military strategy. So he's certainly well-versed and experienced on this topic. So welcome back to Real Space Strategy, Brent.
Hey, thanks, Chris. Glad to be back. Thanks for having me again.
No problem. So as you probably noticed in the news, and obviously the last several decades, that there's been this notion of the post-Cold War world was that free trade was kind of the thing. And there are still people that are pushing for free trade and others that have kind of think that that is no longer around or shouldn't be around anymore. Can you explain what free trade is and if and when this system became a thing? Has everyone embraced free trade as part of their economic instruments? And if no, why?
Well, that's a big question. What free trade is and what free trade what people think free trade is might be significantly different. The easiest way to explain free trade is to use the American experience, and that's between states. In the United States, even though each state is supposed to be its own state, right, on the international stage, there are no economic barriers between the states where you can't tax or force duties to be paid upon goods that come from New Mexico to Texas or, you know, between any other state. This is where free trade would be, you know, free movement of goods without undue government interference and other things like that. Even in the United States, we have certain things like California will take a look at your fruit before you go inside it, just to make sure you don't bring in anything bad or something like that. But really, if you want to have a business relationship in a different state, it's very easy to do so. And you don't have to worry about the government taxing you or doing anything like that that would influence your prices necessarily. But free trade between actual, you know, states, you know, countries between, say, the United States and China, the free trade theory would be you should be able to trade between those countries without any duties or other trade barriers that would add a lot of cost for government reasons. It would cost a lot of money, let's say, to transport goods from China to the United States simply because you have to go across the ocean. But the free trade, that would be a free trade barrier, certainly, but it would not be a government imposed added 10%, 15%, or an added duty to just add another government revenue stream, let's say. So free trade among all countries, in theory, is supposed to be an expression of liberalism, in classic liberalism, or really libertarianism nowadays, where the state shouldn't have any say between two private individuals, and these private individuals being one in, say, Beijing and one in Washington, D.C., should be able to trade without undue influence by either government. That's what free trade theoretically would be. Nowadays, people seem to think that free trade is just sort of how we won the Cold War. Capitalism won against the Soviet Union and communism, right? So free trade is, of course, something that we like. But in reality, very few, if any, probably no country actually has free trade, in that it doesn't impose any duties or barriers government to government, or from a government to a private individual wanting to trade in that country from external, who wants to import into the United States or export into the United States and import from the United States. That very rarely, if ever, happens and doesn't happen. So when people talk about, oh my gosh, there's tariffs now, they sort of assume that there weren't tariffs before, which is most often not the case.
So I was thinking as you were talking, one of the things in several of my master's programs and things that I've heard about working in the DC sphere is another theory that usually sometimes goes along with free trade, and that's economic interdependence theory, which is the more open and free trade you have with countries and the more integrated your economies become, wars will be less likely, if not gone completely, because you're too invested in each other to want to fight and destroy each other, which, you know, as you probably know, and some of our listeners probably know if they're history buffs, that was kind of what things were like in Europe before World War I, and it didn't turn out so well. So is that an accurate statement of people kind of lob those two together?
Well, that is an excellent point, and I'm glad to bring it up, because free trade, honestly, is a foreign policy issue, and it has been for a long time. Economically, free trade is very difficult to defend, even though a lot of people do, using David Ricardo's classic argument about trade between England and Portugal for Portuguese wine and English wool, right? But there's a lot of problems with that from a theoretical point of view, and a practical historical view as well. So economically, yeah, free trade doesn't really work that well, but the foreign policy establishments tend to do that anyway. Early on, because they thought that the more powers traded amongst each other, the more peaceful they would be, which, again, that was that theory was put forward best in 1913. And then a few months later, World War I happened, and that ended the first, you know, idea of globalism in the modern historical context. But nothing dies harder than an idea that sounds good to a bureaucrat or an academic, right? So now, what we consider free trade nowadays, especially among NATO countries and sort of the West in general, is a historical aberration when the United States, who was essentially the winner of World War II, didn't have to do much to rebuild since its homeland was not repaired, tried to do its best to repair Western Europe and other places by allowing, in the Marshall Plan and other things, but even in trade policy, allowing countries to export to the United States more than they imported, and build their economies by essentially vampiring from the United States. And, countries like Great Britain and France had a lot of barriers to trade, but they were allowed to export their goods to the United States, even though the people originally in the United States knew that was economically harmful, but they thought it was good enough because they bought the foreign policy. They got foreign policy gains from these economic losses to rebuild allies. Unfortunately, over time, this trade kept on going, and now you can't really argue too much that, losing more and more of our wealth to, you know, so-called allies, and they are allies, but economically they're parasites, like Canada or Great Britain or France or Germany or all these other Japan and all these places that have trade surpluses with the United States, and the United States has trade deficits with them. They keep gaining, we keep losing, and a lot of people, including the present administration, don't see what benefit the United States has with these lousy, trade imbalances that we share with most all of the world today.
Right. And I guess speaking back to that, speaking of the current administration and back to the United States, economic power is one of the instruments of national power, obviously. You got diplomatic, information, military, economic. And each of these tools are what the president has at his disposal to achieve strategic effects or advance American strategic interests. And tariffs is obviously a subset of that economic instrument. Sanctions is probably more popular because we hear about it a lot since the 90s. It's sort of the go-to place. But tariffs are kind of in the news. What are the purpose of tariffs, since we were talking about that earlier? And why do you think people in the press and elsewhere seem to think that tariffs are bad and more harmful to Americans than to the country they are levied against, since you mentioned some of that trade imbalance thing?
Sure. There's a lot to that question, too. Generally, tariffs are established to generate government revenue, which people don't really remember too much, especially now in the public conscience. The Coast Guard was originally, the revenue cutter service, specifically designed to, take tariff duties from people that were trading with the United States early on, but generate government revenue and to protect strategic domestic industries. And that's for, defense purposes and economic reasons as well. A lot of people understand what they consider free trade theory, in that free trade is supposed to make everyone richer. That's not really what it does. Free trade theory, if it's true, only promises to maximize production worldwide, however long however wide your model is. But it doesn't tell you where those advantages go. And, that's especially here in the United States right now, it tends to go, the advantages of trade, free trade, goes towards whatever factor of production the country has more of. And the United States has always had more capital than labor. So over the last, half century, essentially, this era of trade with massive trade deficits and other such things would go, people would benefit. And the people that benefited generally are the people that held capital, which was, the rich, the millionaires, the billionaires, and to buy off the American people, the middle class, those that had 401ks or otherwise owned stocks, right? So not to sound too communist, because it's not, it's just reality. people benefit, and the people that benefit from the current situation, or at least which was the current situation before President Trump, were people that held capital. And the losers were the workers. And it is pretty clear that the real wages of American workers haven't increased since the mid-70s. And it's not just the workers that have been hurt and the people with political power and the wealth have, gotten richer. It's also that, the foreign policy establishment in the United States has for the longest time said, hey, this is great. The economic miracles of the last couple of decades have been wonderful because we've pulled billions of people worldwide out of poverty. Well, that's true. The cost was the Rust Belt, for lack of a better term. And,
And if people don't know what the Rust Belt is, what is the Rust Belt?
Well, the industrial Midwest, Cleveland, Chicago, Detroit, other places that were massive production facilities and, the industrial heart of the United States that won us World War II were hollowed out. Mm-hmm. And we were hollowed out because of the commitment to free trade that the United States had, but other countries like China, Japan, Canada to a lesser extent, but a real extent, Mexico, that happened and some people benefited. You could argue that maybe the American foreign policy establishment benefited, but the American people, very hard argument. And in reality, a lot of the people that voted in President Trump were the victims of this American elite mentality for as long as they were.
You mean the folks who used to have those manufacturing jobs that are now kind of a popular promise of the last campaign cycle? So speaking of that, I know another term that's been thrown around is trade war. And as I understand it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but just because you're using sanctions or tariffs does not make it a trade war per se. And typically, when I've heard the phrase trade war, usually it means a trade dispute that becomes a hot war is a trade war. But people are using tariffs going back and forth to be a war, quote unquote. Are tariffs really all that makes a trade war? And if not, how do you know you're in a real trade war? And does it matter that these people in the press are using that phrase? Is that accurate or what?
Well, I suppose if you look through history, you can find wars that started over trade and trade wars, maybe the Opium War being one of them. China refused to balance its payments with the with Great Britain, exporting tea and not importing anything other than silver, which the Great Britain refused to do. So they forced trade upon them. But really, I would say that trade war nowadays is just a slander term for industrial policy from free trade cultists. It's a propaganda term. Most people would tend to agree that nations have the right to trade or not trade with whoever they please. That's part of being a sovereign country. But this new idea that that there's a trade war if there's ever a disagreement about tariffs, things can get heated and things can get, not economically, led, like reciprocal tariffs and, retaliations and stuff like that. And people don't think all this all the way through. But the idea that a country is attacked by a tariff generally assumes that a foreign nation has a right to force their goods upon you in your nation, which is complete nonsense. So the idea of trade war is a negative thing to try to get people against it, or really to get people scared. And it works. I'm not sure if it's going to work enough today, but trade war is just a slander term for industrial policy. If you're going to use this trade war idea to where, hey, reciprocal tariffs are going to keep going on until someone cries uncle, the U.S. is going to win any trade war very handily, for two reasons. One is that the U.S. already has massive trade deficits. Of what I saw just recently, the 2024 GDP, it's losing 3% of its GDP by foreign trade in its net exports. Its imports are far greater than its exports. So we're already losing trade. If we start fighting, maybe we'll actually start gaining some ground. The people that lose are going to be the people that have the trade surpluses with us already that boosts their GDP. So we're already losing. We might as well fight. The other one is that the United States has a massive internal market, and we are about as close to any country that can be fully autonomous. Autarkic is the economic word, can produce everything we need essentially by ourselves. So if we stop getting certain things from Canada or China or anything like that, there's nothing stopping us from producing it ourselves. And if we produce it internally, that automatically boosts our GDP higher than, it's ever been before. Right now, we're assuming that 2 to 3% is good growth. We lose that much in foreign trade. Now, over the long term, substituting those foreign goods with domestically produced material will double our GDP growth, at least using, not considering anything else, but considering if we have more jobs, more production in the United States, that's going to increase consumption by a lot. The idea that we're going to lose is ridiculous, and it's a short-term thinking. The people that are screaming the most are the people that can't see the long-term benefits because of their short-term views of whatever they're doing at the moment, be it looking at their 401ks, you know, oh my gosh, they lost 2%, which I'm going to get back tomorrow, but right now I'm scared to death. Or the short-term government or the short-term firm choices that they've made under the assumption that there would not be these tariffs. So there, short-term, there might be some serious changes that might impact certain firms, but the long-term growth is nothing but positive.
So there are some things that I wanted to make people aware of who are listening, just in case they wonder. So when you're talking about fighting, you're talking about kind of what you're seeing right now in the news where, hey, these trade deficits are not sustainable anymore. We need to have a more even keel, which is the phrase reciprocal tariff, just means you're evening out the trade between the two countries. So where the duties and taxes are of an equal nature between, say, Canada, and United States, or whoever the country is.
Yes, no violence involved. No real right. violence. No Clausewitzian violence involved.
Yes. But and I think – go ahead. Sorry.
Well, there are going to be some people that are short-term going to be harmed by it. And this is why the news media is harping on about, you know, recession. So it's – not good to say, hey, look, there might not be some short-term adjustments that might be somewhat painful. That will probably happen, especially for firms that can't change with the times. But the advantages completely outweigh the downsides.
There's another thing. There was an agreement that in the first Trump administration called the USMCA, the US-Mexico-Canada agreement. It was the replacement for the NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement, that was sort of an early 90s thing as part of this post-Cold War globalization economic interdependency kind of push.
Yeah, Ross Perot was right.
Well, yeah. So one thing that I mentioned, the reason why I bring it up is because there's a lot of things that come to mind when you were discussing that. First is I think a lot of this probably is because our economic education, basic economic education, is probably not as good as it could be or should be in the school system. And that's – I remember when I was an undergraduate in Missouri, I had to take as part of my degree program a micro and a macroeconomics course. So I had to take two courses, one for each. And we were required as part of the class to read Wall Street Journal and other things so we could discuss current events in the economy and trade and everything as part of our real-world practical discussion of the stuff we were learning in class, like supply-demand and all that kind of stuff. And one of the things he said that the professor I had said is, okay, I know a lot of you guys don't understand the point of all this right now, but he said, keep in mind that you are probably only 3% of the American population who understands now how the economy works in a free market capitalist system, because a lot of people don't understand that. Like they didn't understand that, you know, zero unemployment is not good. It's not realistic. You want to have at least some supply and demand, even in the job market, just like you would in any other market. And when USMCA came up, it was sort of the beginning of kind of what we're seeing now is President Trump and his administration were trying to fix some of these trade issues. And Canada, according to a couple of books of people who were there who written about this, stated that Mexico was a whole lot more open, you know, in private than our neighbors to the north, rather. And as a result of that, it was going to be just the USMA, because Canada, under Justin Trudeau, who's now since no longer the prime minister, basically was doing kind of what the Canadians are doing right now, throwing kind of a fit, and had to be drug and said, okay, well, tell you what, we're going to do this with or without you. So if you want to be left behind in this deal, then that's up to you. And so they eventually came at the last minute and signed the agreement. And as I understand, and you could tell me if I'm wrong, the trade imbalance, what exactly does that mean? And why wasn't that fixed with USMCA? I thought that was kind of the point. Or are they just not keeping to what they agreed to? I'm talking about the Canadians now with USMCA.
Well, it's, you know, this just goes to show you that we don't have free trade, because a real free trade agreement would be about a sentence or two long, or a paragraph if you want to get legalese. But most of these agreements run for hundreds of pages because there's always exceptions and all this other kind of stuff. I can't say that I know a whole lot about the new agreement, but it was very clear. Earlier I said that Ross Perot was right. Well, most of the really bad accelerated views of globalization happened because of NAFTA, which was the, you know, North American Free Trade Agreement. And that was really where...
Oh, hang on one second. I just remembered this. So Ross Perot, didn't he have something about the large sucking sound?
Yeah, the giant sucking sound of all our jobs going south.
The giant sucking sound. Okay, now I remember what you're talking about. You know, okay, go ahead.
A great industrialist, Naval Academy graduate, and, you know, defender of the people. But, you know, maybe had too nasally a voice, but, you know, I'm not one to complain. But... yeah, that's where the free trade stuff started in earnest. And if you think about what Perot said versus what, you know, Clinton and Bush said during their presidential debates about this, it was pretty clear that what happened was Perot. The deindustrialization of the United States and then the rise of globalization, where the, you know, people that were in favor of this didn't say that it was helping Americans anymore. It was saying, oh, don't worry, the United States is just supposed to be on a slow decline. This is natural. This is normal. This is to be expected. And of course, none of it was true. They just wanted to lull people into the, you know, a false sense of security that, don't worry, the people that are losing their jobs are only the uneducated people. Are only the people that are across the tracks and then across the street. And then, yeah, it might have been you, but you sort of are lousy anyway. And we lost some of our greatest cities because of this. And the free traders have no, and economists nowadays don't have any real response to it other than, well, it was inevitable. And then it's like, well, why was it inevitable? It's like, well, because free trade is good. And then most people don't really think much beyond about it. So I would argue, actually, I would take a little bit of exception with what you were saying in that a lot of people understand economic theory, but they do not understand economic history. So we have bad theory being taught and history being ignored. The greatest industrial power of the early industrial age was Great Britain. Right? Why is that? Mm-hmm. Well, because they had a lot of coal. They built the machines that could do steam engine, you know, manufacturing first, and they had access to a bunch of raw materials over the empire, right? And they protected that empire through the, you know, navigation laws, corn laws, other things like that. But they became very, very strong. And then in the 1870s, 1880s, they started embracing free trade. And they rapidly lost their industrial dominance to people that were protective and had a lot of tariffs, had a lot of industrial policy. Germany and the United States. The United States has never been one for, you know, free trade. We've always protected our industries. And we became the industrial powerhouse. And then when we started to embrace free trade in the 90s, who did we bring along? In the World Trade Organization?
China.
Yeah, we became free traders.
And we gave them most favored nation trading status, which is a extra special.
Sure.
Right. So with that, here's just a thought. I'm trying to think of this question I had. I'll just go on to the next one I had. So with all this grand strategic and economic power background that we've been talking about for the last 20 some minutes, a lot of people on the space trade press have been bringing in the space industry and space power issues into this mix as as being a concern, like, oh, this is going to hurt our space industry and our space advantage because it's so reliant on partnerships and things, and being quote unquote protectionist is not going to help anything. We're not going to have dominance or quote leadership. We're going to falter. Is there any truth to this, or is what the president has been stating about everything from steel and other things about it helping our industry accurate, or is it somewhere in the middle? What's your assessment of that?
It depends on what your time frame is. And the people that are screaming bloody murder about this kind of stuff are short-term thinkers, and are thinking in the short term, what is going to be the impact, in a couple of, the next quarter, or are we going to be able to get the materials that we need? I heard, I think it might have been it was either on the podcast itself or a LinkedIn post that I saw about it, about Canadian nickel being important for the U.S. space industry. I'm not sure if that's true or not. I couldn't look into it, but let's assume that it is. And these tariffs that were going to be, put on the nickel will make the nickel more expensive. Yes, that's true. The question is not, why did you make my nickel more expensive? The real strategic question is to ask is, why doesn't the United States have its own nickel? And it's not that we don't have mines. It's that we've chosen through industrial policy, environmental policy, to not, to essentially tax it out of existence, where there's only one mine, I believe, in Michigan or something like that. Even though there are reserves, maybe not a lot, but enough around the country. So when people argue, hey, this is going to hurt my bottom line, that's true. But why is it that why is it the country decided that we needed to rely on a foreign source for strategic materials, especially if it's an ally like China? But then they stopped it or decided to increase the tariffs a lot simply because we had a dispute about fentanyl. So the strategic question is, why is it the United States not producing it themselves? And the other issue that I just want to get really quick is the people that argue that, it's going to hurt our export market. Other people are going to take the export market. Almost invariably, the export market in the United, for the United States is always something that people think exists, but in reality never pans out. The big one again is China. We were like, hey, we'll give them a whole bunch of incentives the most favored nation status, all that other stuff, because think of all the billion people that we're going to be able to export all our goods to. And did that ever happen since the 90s? No, it didn't. Not to the level that they exported to us. So okay. A lot of people that say, hey, we're losing the foreign markets for our spacecraft. If people are using that, I'm guarantee you, it's nowhere near as big as a robust domestic market would be.
I remember, I think it was 2010 during Obama term one. It was probably about a year and a half after I came to DC in my first space policy gig, and I was working industrial base issues primarily. And I remembered the Obama administration at that time was looking at not only continuing to push a lot of this to where we're relying on other sources for rare earth metals and other things needed for spacecraft components and things, both national security and other stuff, but they were also selling off mass quantities from the strategic national stockpile and were planning on shutting down whole facilities. And of course, that became a big issue with, various foundries and other, production sites around the country that had already shrunken quite a bit over since 1991, when they had the so-called Last Supper meeting in the Pentagon, where they said, we don't need you guys anymore. You figure it out how you consolidate and merge or die. And as a result of that, it took about another 10 years for all that to stop on the Defense Logistics Agency side with respect to the stockpiles, because China had pretty much gained control through their own counter influence, using a lot of the money they made through the system that we created in the 90s and using all their special perks we gave them to develop to gain dominance of at least, I think it was 75 or 80% of all rare earth metals in the world. And some of that, and most of that's in their own territory, but they also started signing agreements in other parts of the world as their early stages of Belt and Road. And we had shut down a lot of mines, uranium, all sorts of stuff. So I remember that being a big deal to the economic folks working all the different space programs. What kind of economic tools do you think should be leveraged to aid American space policy and strategy advantages through the economic toolkit? Or should that be something to be avoided? In other words, when you see like the president's speeches and some of the congressional folks talking about what they want to do, both commercial space, national security, and even the civil exploration stuff, is economic instruments something that we could use to gain or aid space power advancement? Or is space power advancement something that is more on its own?
No, I think that the space industry especially is one of the more strategic and strategically valuable industries that we have, not only for what it does now, but for what its growth could be in the future as a massive growth engine for the United States. So the issue that we have is that the tariff is a signal to the economy, to the markets, that firms have to adjust to the new reality. And adjusting is a little bit difficult. So let's assume that mm-hmm. nickel is still the big thing. If it's too expensive to get nickel from Canada or from, Indonesia or something like that, and we have to, you know, that's really going to hurt, the government should ensure that they get all the red tape out of the way and as many loans as is necessary to start opening up what we do have here and start producing our own strategic resources. That seems to be what the administration is trying to do. But we have to do that pretty fast because the government is changing the game on the firms. And it's probably it is going to be for the best in the midterm and the long term, especially. But the short term, you know, a firm has to go from short term to short term or else it'll fold. So it does need the industry, just like many industries, are going to need to be sort of shepherded along a little bit to adjust to the new realities. And that is a good use of strategic resources from the government, which they should be getting a whole heck of a lot of from the tariffs. Because again, remember, the tariff is not just a penalty, it's revenue. Someone's going to pay it or the trade isn't going to happen. So if the trade does happen in the short term, the government's getting a lot of money. That money should be invested back into the industry that the money's been generated from, or the people themselves who might suffer a lot of short-term consequences of these actions, although our working class has already suffered long term for these problems of free trade and just mm-hmm. no one's said anything about it. When you have tariff barriers, you're going to have enough money to adjust your economy, and you need to do it very, very fast in order to make the issues as insignificant and as quickly done as possible. Just like a person that, if you drink an awful lot, the headache's coming. How do you avoid a hangover? You keep drinking. The problem is eventually you're going to die. So the idea is, the responsible third party, between the exporter that's tariffing the heck out of you to get the goods that you need and the government that sort of did this to you, is the government should give you an aspirin and give you a whole lot of water, maybe a cup of coffee afterwards, to make it the pain go away as quickly as possible so you can get healthy again.
So quick question before we wrap up here. You mentioned near-term potential not so much fun and then midterm and long-term gain. how many years are we looking at? Is it possible to see positive results economically within the term of the current administration, or is this something that will take a decade to show results?
The beauty of the American economy especially is that it is very, very fast when it needs to be. So I would say it's very, very doable to have a lot of this these problematic issues out of the way relatively quickly in this first term. Absolutely. If you can get Congress to do what it needs to do to make sure this, the changes happen. Anti-Trump people don't throw a monkey wrench in there to where they keep the pain of the tariffs, but not the corrective measures otherwise to complete the transition to, the new economy. It can be very, very, it can be made very difficult, but if allowed to, if the American people are allowed to adjust as is necessary and reduce the regulatory burden for rebuilding the, industrial base of the United States, it can be very, very fast. Because economics isn't just, industrial activity isn't going to stop. Eventually, people will pay the tariffs if that's the only thing that they can do. But the steeper the tariff, the more, incentive you have to get your own sources, right? And that's more business opportunities. So business opportunities, because of the tariffs, are going to increase almost immediately as well. So you're going to have brand new firms coming up very quickly, even while the older firms might have a more difficult transition period. So it can be very fast. It can be very, very fast, but you need to commit to it. Because if people are like, no, you can just keep drinking, don't worry about it, the headache will last a lot longer because you won't get rid of it. But again, the economy has to heal. And what you really want is more or less balanced trade over the long term, where no one has extraordinary surpluses and no one has extraordinary deficits, because that's where trade is most useful for everybody. When you trade enough to keep everything balanced, but you get the productive advantages, the surplus of Canada, exporting things that Canadians are really good at, and taking in turn payment for, stuff that the, United States can produce more efficiently. That's where global economics really become, it hits the sweet spot. And that's what should be aimed for.
Awesome. Great. Well, we're out of time. So again, I want to say thank you again to Dr. Brent Zarnik for coming on to discuss this this timely topic. And again, stay tuned for those that are looking forward to the next live event. Those are coming, so keep watching those on LinkedIn and the website. And from Christopher Stone and all the people here at NIDS, thank you for joining us for Real Space Strategy. Thank you for listening to NIDS Knowledge, Real Space Strategy. The Real Space Strategy Edition is produced under NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent on donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I want to thank our producer, Kimberly Sherrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative NIDS Knowledge.